I have a message from another time. A-Ray Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword, No. 2, Second Movement, Blue Moon Serenade, by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that's me. With Ann Cross and Chris Overstreet. Wednesday, August 31st, 2405. 9:17 a.m. Deedlet Satori Mandeville Memorial Institute, Gerardo, Republic of Bajor. As she had every morning for the past week, Utena Tenjo woke up, sat up, and briefly wondered where the hell she was. The room she was in wasn't the beige cinder-blocked familiarity that had been Morgan 412, which the part of her mind that was in back-to-school mode was still unconsciously expecting. It also wasn't the little cabin aboard the one-hit wonder where she'd spent half the summer, or the comfortable little bedroom in Skold Ravenhair's cottage on Tomodachi where she'd spent the other half. This room was large and round, with a large picture window dominating one side, a high ceiling, and walls of reddish-gold stone. The window looked out over a lovely little lake, with a cozy town tucked up against the far bank, huddled at the foot of a range of impressive, craggy mountain peaks. But the heavy drapes were closed right now, blocking the view. Because of the shape, the room always made her think for an instant that she'd somehow woken up back in the White Tower at Otori Academy, though that was clearly absurd. That room had been smaller, and mostly blue, and the window there had been much taller than it was wide. Then, and only then, did she reach a high enough level of consciousness to remember that she was in her new home, Room 501, the castle. True to Wakaba's prediction, it never had managed to acquire a proper name for itself. 4 days left until classes began. Tomorrow was course registration day. But today... Today, Utena Tenjo decided to sleep until noon. Caitlin Hutchins, her roommate, woke up about half an hour later, climbed out of bed and into her slippers, and padded across the room to the window, yawning. Careful not to let daylight fall across her sleeping roommate's bed, she peeped out the window and saw to her delight that it was another beautiful day. As it happened, Utena woke up anyway, and, noting that Kate was up, decided to abandon her sleep-till-noon plan. She got up, too. And seeing that she'd risen, Kate smiled and opened the drapes, flooding the room with light. It was, as Utena had noted to herself before, a large room, occupying as it did the entire inside diameter of the castle's west tower. It went from wall to wall without interruption, except for the furniture. The only permanent feature was the spiral staircase which entered from below and continued on up to the roof. Utena, who over the course of the summer had found herself, to her great surprise, becoming interested in astronomy again, was thinking about putting a telescope up there. It was a far cry from Morgan 412, that relentlessly beige, rough-brown carpeted, much-abused, rather cramped enclosure with its balky little window, its boring, battered industrial furniture, and its glaring fluorescent light. The floor here was covered with a cluster of nice oriental rugs, including the one that had graced Morgan 412, which had pride of place in the center. The lights were tertiary halogens, which filled the room with a warm glow when Bahava L couldn't provide that same service through the bay window. The furniture had been built by Caitlin and a Minbari friend of hers named Chinan. It wasn't fancy, Kate called the style shaker, but it was sturdy, and there was a certain elegance in its simplicity that the WPI standard issue had entirely lacked. There were 2 desks, big, sturdy ones, with drawers that could actually hold things, next to each other along one side, their back edges curved to conform to the wall. There was a pair of large wardrobes, each flanked by a chest of drawers. Much of the remaining wall space was occupied by shelves, some holding books, others Kate's stuffed tiger collection, what wasn't on her bed, and Utrin's teacup collection, except, of course, for the upright piano. The acoustic damper web Kate had built for Morgan 412 to keep the piano from disturbing her neighbors wasn't necessary here. There was no one above them, or to either side, and thanks to the thick stone floor, you could have a fully amped rock concert in 501, and it would be completely inaudible in 401, the single bedroom wedged into the corner, directly beneath the tower. Kate could play the piano, or her guitar, or any of her impressive number of electronic instruments, and not be in danger of disturbing anyone but Utina, as long as the windows were closed. All in all, the atmosphere of the new campus reminded Utina, again, as Wakaba had predicted, much more of Otori Academy than of the Worcester Preparatory Institute. WPI had been converted from an abandoned college, deliberately reconstructed and maintained as a working historic site in its late 20th century configuration, and though adequate, its facilities had always had a certain, well, soulless industrial flavor. DSM was brand new and had been designed with the aid of people who had struggled with WPI's physical limitations for years, the school's administrators. The WDF Corps of Engineers 3rd Battalion had worked closely with President Tiefeld, Dean Montaigne, and the on-hand students, mainly the Duelist Society, to make the new school answer all the shortcomings of the old. The campus was spacious, green, and beautifully landscaped, not wedged into the middle of a post-industrial city. It had a full range of athletic facilities, a student center which boasted an honest-to-God ballroom, a performing arts complex that didn't resemble a small converted church, and a dining hall that was actually elegant as well as functional. Inside, the student accommodations, except for the castle, which was on a whole separate level, looked more like bedrooms in someone's home than dormitory cells, with nice views, windows that worked, non-40-grit carpet, and furniture designed for the use of actual human beings, or their equivalent. Being handmade by the person whose room it was, the beds in Castle 501 were atypical. They were fully queen-sized. But even in the regular residence halls, there were doubles, not WPI's accursed 36-inch narrow twins, and they had proper box springs. Such touches did not go unnoticed by the incoming students or their parents, many of whom wanted to know what they were paying for before they sent their children off to be educated in the wilds of a Bajoran moon. Nearly all of them left satisfied. Many of them left lamenting that they couldn't have gone to a place as nice as that. The students themselves were, by and large, enthralled, especially those returning from WPI's historic austerity. At any rate, because of all that, it struck Utina as much more similar to her old school, Otori Academy, than WPI. That didn't mean she disliked the place. True, she had some bad memories of Otori Academy, but she also had good ones, and there had never been a time when she didn't think the place was a beautiful setting, however troubling the story playing out in it was. She had the same attitude toward DSM, and a much more optimistic view of her future there. In the weeks since she'd been back from deep space, she'd spent a lot of her time exploring the campus, and at every turn she saw another thing about it that delighted her and made her think, Himemia will like that. That thought ran through her head again, as she stood next to Kate in the window bay and looked out at Lake Jaradar and the craggy peaks of the Forlean Mountains. You know, she said wryly, I think we've done all right for ourselves, for a bunch of displaced fugitives. Kate grinned. She said. I think. They went downstairs, showered, then came back up and got dressed for the day. This was the one inconvenient thing about living in Castle 501, and it was a small price to pay for that view. Then, ready for the world, they went downstairs, and Utina gleefully put to use another of the many improvements in their living situation that had come with the translation to Gerardo. The castle had a kitchen. Utina Tenjo was a good cook, had been for years. It was one of her favorite hobbies, probably the most domestic thing about her, and the trait people who had just met her, bold, forthright manner, sword, boy's uniform, and all, least expected. She didn't see any particular discontinuity in it herself. A person wanted to live well, she had to eat well, and the best way to ensure that you had good food to eat was to cook it yourself. Besides, at the academy, she'd been cast adrift in an empty dorm without a domestic staff, so it was either cook, schlep clear across campus to the dining commons, or starve. Or, shudder, let a Mimia cook. Over the previous summer, she'd spent a lot of time, when not out roaming the galaxy on practical skill exercises, at Corwin Ravenhair's Aunt Belle Dandy's house on Tomodachi. Aunt Belle was a cook of legendary ability, and Utena had become something of an apprentice to her in this arena, as she was Corwin's in spaceflight. Utena had come away with even greater respect for the craft, broadened culinary horizons, and an itching need to put her new training to use. It had made her look forward to getting at the castle's kitchen all the more.
What's on the menu this morning? Asked Kate, with a little grin as Utena hung her jacket on a peg, rolled up her shirt sleeves, and put on an apron.
Waffles, Utena replied. Duelists wandered in, one by one, drawn by that strange radar-like sense that all true chowhounds have, which can rouse a person from a sound sleep and send them drifting to the kitchen, even if they couldn't smell the food cooking from where they started out. And as they arrived, Utena fed them. Kyuichi Sayonji, who had spent half the previous school year making breakfast for her in his capacity as morning grill guy at the Morgan Hall snack bar, had encountered the reversal of roles with puzzled equanimity last Friday, Utena's first morning in the castle. Somehow, in 2 years of knowing her, he had managed not to learn that she could cook.
Pancakes?
He inquired as he entered the combination kitchen-dining room just off the dojo.
Waffles, Utena replied. Bacon or sausage?
Bacon, said Sayonji. Yawning, he went to the percolator and got himself a cup of coffee. Last of the students should be arriving today.
Yep, said Utena as she busied herself with the next waffle pour. Isn't Liza supposed to get in this afternoon?
Mmm, said Sayonji, dropping a couple of sugar lumps into his coffee. Skaya and I are planning to take the bus up to B5 and greet her.
Sounds like a good idea. I think I'll join you.
What the hell, I've got nothing better to do, said Utena, flipping bacon into a skillet. Mind if I tag along, too?
Why not? The more the merrier, Sayonji replied.
He took a seat at the long table, sipped his coffee, and added,
I wonder what sort of change her summer of adventure will have made in her.
I shudder to think, said Utena dryly.
Morning, everyone,
chirped Ezelin Devere Natashkin as she trotted in. She took a sniff.
Pancakes?
Waffles, said Utena. Ezelin was informed of Sayonji and Sky's plan, and eagerly invited herself as well. She had unfinished business with Liza from the fall before, and was keen to have it out of the way. Before Utena was finished cooking, three more duelists came in. All of them tried to guess. Two of them guessed wrong, leaving Miki to wander in last, speculate,
Waffles?
And receive in reply, Waff... Yeah.
You don't have to cook for us like this, you know, said Ezelin. You could make us get our own breakfast.
Utena shrugged.
I don't mind, she said. Maybe when classes start and I'm actually in a hurry in the morning, she added with a grin, I'll make Sayonji do it again.
Sayonji tried to look put upon, but failed. After breakfast, the others pitched in to help clean up the kitchen, and then they all went outside, just for the sake of being out on such a nice day. As they walked down the path to the main campus in a small, chatting group, the soft roar of an incoming spaceship caught Wakaba's ear.
Was Corwin going to come by today? She wondered, pointing at the dark blip in the morning sky. It wasn't the one-hit wonder, however, nor was it Dagger Disc. What it was a gray and brown monstrosity nearly three times Dagger Disc's length, vaguely resembling a trilobite with a stack of ion thrusters sticking out from its shell. It bore down steadily on the newly built campus until, with a loud roar of engines, it buzzed the buildings, rattling a few windows as it soared off to the horizon to make a leisurely circle back to the spaceport. The ship, although going respectably fast, had been slow enough for the duelists to see the golden Thunderbolt flag painted on its bow, and the markings CFA No Bull, CFA 5290, beneath. Mac, Kate murmured, remembering a Cessna plane buzzing Moose's van in upstate New York. There hadn't been a single Freespacer ship at Port Geradar since the home fleet departed the system. Who? Wakaba asked. Mackenzie? I didn't think he was that crazy. Ask Jacron about it sometime if you want an earful. Miki smiled. My only question is, where did Mac find enough money for his spaceship? That wasn't his spaceship, Kate muttered. That was a fossil. The answers came later, when Mac Mackenzie rode up on the shuttle bus, looking much less stressed out than he usually did after an interstellar voyage. Morning, he said. Has housing opened up yet? Was that your ship? Wakaba asked. The one that nearly broke every window on campus? Hyperbole, Mac said, and I steered well clear of the castle anyway. That was my summer's income, he added. The hull of an old Corellian star cab. It's nearly 2,000 years old, but they built things thick back then. Reinforced with scrap duralloy plating from the shipyards, refurbished engines. She'll do 68 megalites sublight and a flat factor one in hyperspace, he added with a shudder. And all the basic amenities. It's amazing what you can buy for 5,000 credits, if you know where to look. Why? Three people asked at once, and Mac shrugged. I need income, he said, during school breaks and on weekends. I was flying bush on Earth, into and out of the Badlands, but there's no place to fly to on this moon. The Noble, he grinned at his own pun, can haul freight, it can haul people, and it can haul a respectable little bit of ass. No, Wakaba asked, why that beast? Mac shrugged. Cheap. Then he looked down and noticed his hand trembling slightly, and he said again, so how about that housing, hm? The adrenaline's wearing off, and I could really use a lie-down about now. Chenan took charge of getting Mackenzie to the residential life office. Others wandered off in various directions, just enjoying being outside and free to do whatever. Sionji, Kate, Skaya, Azalin, and Utena piled into Vlad the Impala and headed down to the bus stop, thence to Babylon 5 to greet Liza Broadbank. Liza was an interesting case. For years, she'd been Kate's self-appointed arch-foe. Well, self-appointed wasn't really accurate. She'd been appointed by her father, a powerful corporate executive who hated the semi-formal immortal cadre, who, on paper or not, pretty much ruled the Republic of Zeta Cygni. Since that cadre quite prominently featured Caitlin's parents, Ephraim and Alicia Broadbank had very carefully produced three children, one who would be in the same school year as Caitlin, one the same as her younger brother Leonard, and one for their younger siblings, the twins, Guy and Pris. The sheer amount of ruthless calculation these acts embodied sometimes left Utena, when she stopped to think about it, grappling with a grudging mixture of awe and loathing. These three daughters, Elizabeth, Clarissa, and Marietta, found themselves indoctrinated from an early age into their parents' hatred of Caitlin's, and the others of their social class, and each was sent to the same schools as whichever contemporary she had. In two out of those three cases, they had succeeded. Liza had grown from a spoiled, petty child into a spoiled, petty adolescent, fixated on Caitlin but too craven to attack her directly most of the time. Clarissa was even worse, but she had a larger group of opposition. Leonard had a lot of contemporaries, including his half-brother Corwin, because of the timing of the Ragnarok and the celebrations which followed it. Toward the end of the previous school year, though, Liza had overextended herself and very nearly paid for it by spending the rest of her life in thrall to the Earth Alliance's shadowy Psi Corps. Unknown to herself, she harbored a rare and powerful psionic talent, one for which the Corps did not find itself above brainwashing and perjury to get hold of, even if its holder were a citizen of a nation which did not recognize their authority. The experience, and the awakening of her power, left Liza a wreck. And then, at her darkest moment, the people she had spent her life hating and scheming against, the people from whom she could least expect kindness, showed her exactly that. Between them, Sionchi, Skaya, and Caitlin had shown her forgiveness and a new direction, and Liza had latched onto them with both hands, eager to make something better of what remained of herself. She'd spent the summer aboard a deep space trader, operated by Sky's Barsavian Scrang trading house, Ishkarat, as a bottom-ranked spaceman. A position usually held by Scrang in the grip of Kaisa, that species' excruciating version of adolescence. The spirit of the river was due at Babylon 5 in 1 hour, so the four duelists and friend went to the Marché Mouvenpick in the Zocalo, got some bread, cheese, and sodas, and staked out one of the tables to wait for the announcement of the Scrang vessel's arrival. The hour passed without any announcement, then another. Finally, Sky said he would go and inquire of the station's recently installed Ishkarat trading office as to the reason for the delay. While he was gone, an uneasy silence settled over the four remaining at the table. It was Utina who finally said what they were all thinking. "I hope nothing's wrong." Kate nodded, but she looked as if she suspected that hope was a vain one. Sky returned a few minutes later, looking disconsolate. He stopped next to the table, his tail making an uneasy circle on the deck behind him, and said, "I just spoke with the head of our trading delegation. She has informed me that the Spirit of the River broadcast a distress call this morning at 11:41 local time, saying that she was under attack by unknown pirates near the Cardassian border. The message was cut off. Since then, nothing. Other Ishkarat ships are making for her last known location, as is the Challenger, but nothing will be known for some time." He sighed deeply, hanging his head. "The honored delegate recommends that we go home. There is nothing to be gained by lingering here." The uneasy silence matured into a full-fledged gloomy one. Sionchi stared blankly at his hands, slack on the table in front of him. Kate closed her eyes as if she had felt a sharp pain. Utina looked concerned for her roommate, fidgeting in obvious frustration with the straw in her spent drink. Azalin looked as though she were about to cry.
"Shazrachakai," she murmured. "It's not fair. She'd only just started becoming who she really was."
"We don't know her fate yet," said Sky gently. "There are survivors of most pirate raids, and the Spirit of the River was a good, strong ship. It's possible they fought their attackers off, but lost their communications equipment. We shouldn't jump to conclusions yet." The Scrang slumped a little. "But I'll admit, it doesn't seem promising."
"So what do we do?" asked Utina. "Take the delegate's advice and go home? Wait it out here? Kate? What do you think?" But it wasn't Caitlin who answered. It was Azalin, her voice smaller still and quavering.
"I want to go home."
Sionchi pulled himself back from wherever he'd gone and looked at the Dentrovian, who was looking down into the melting ice dregs of her soda and looking even more like she would cry at any moment.
"Azalin, are you all right?"
he asked, his voice surprisingly gentle.
"No,"
I'm not,
Ezelin replied in a whisper.
I want to go home. Now.
Let's go, then, said Sionji, rising. The others can stay here if they wish. I'll walk with you back up to campus from the shuttle stop.
No, said Kate, breaking her long silence and standing as well. The delegate's right. There's nothing we can do here. Let's go back. Maybe we'll hear something later.
Sky nodded. The office has promised to call me with any news, he said. It need not be said that I'll pass it on to all interested parties. For that matter, the school's administration, Dean Montaigne at least, should be notified.
Right. Let's go do that, then, said Kate.
The five of them were a bit crowded in Dean Montaigne's new office, which was a little smaller than her old one. They conveyed their unsettling message, promised to keep her posted as new information came in, and then left her to draft an announcement to the school community about their missing classmate. Slowly, downcast, the five filed out of Miss Montaigne's office, Caitlin in the lead, then pulled up short as Kate stopped, startled, in the hallway. Coming out of the admissions office was a girl in a green striped dress who looked a lot like Liza Broadbank.
What's the matter? Asked Sionji.
That girl. That's Clarissa Broadbank. Liza's younger sister.
The one who's even worse than Liza used to be? Utrina asked. Corwin's told me some stories about her.
Kate nodded.
This same. What's she doing here? Does she know?
Clarissa noticed the little group standing near Miss Montaigne's office door and trotted over, light and carefree, to meet them.
Well, hello, Caitlin, she said, smiling. And how are you this fine, fine day? Beautiful institution your daddy's friends have built for you here, isn't it?
Kate, in no mood, refused to rile. She just folded her arms and gave the younger girl the what-do-you-want look.
My good-for-nothing sister was supposed to get in today, wasn't she?
Asked Clarissa, as if she hadn't asked her previous question.
Do you know if she's here yet, Katie darling?
The younger Broadbank's smile became smug as she sang with a nasty glint in her eyes,
I've got an ultimatum from Daddy for her.
Your sister is missing, said Sionji, his voice cold and eyes like slate. Her ship was attacked by pirates this morning. There's been no further word. The IPO is investigating. Clarissa's blue eyes widened.
Pirates, you say? So she's either dead or dragged off to the Outer Rim to be sold as some hut's plaything or the like, then?
The blonde considered this for a moment, then shrugged.
Well, what a shame, she said, with the most sublime lack of sincerity Sionji had seen since the last time he saw Togo. That's all you have to say? Your sister's missing, maybe dead. And all you can do is bat your little blue eyes and say, well, what a shame,
Utrina demanded.
What am I supposed to do? Clarissa replied. Wring my hands and wail? She was an embarrassment to the family anyway. I suppose it's only fitting that she should have such a scandalous end. Daddy will be even angrier knowing what a spectacle that'll make. I suppose it'll be announced to the whole school and they'll make a federal case out of it. Memorial service and all that boring nonsense.
Azalin came out of nowhere, as though she had somehow teleported from the back of the group to the front. She moved so fast that the air made an audible whoomp as it scrambled to get out of her way, and then she reared back and unloaded a full-blooded slap to Clarissa Broadbank's right cheek, knocking the blonde flat on her back in the hallway.
Never speak ill of the dead in my presence,
snarled the Dantrovi in a voice that was barely recognizable as her own. Then she turned and stalked away, off up the corridor. After standing there a moment with a peculiar mixture of amazement and concern on his face, Sionji followed her. Utina stared dumbfounded after them for a moment, then turned her attention back to Clarissa again. The blonde slowly raised her hand and wiped away the trickle of blood the blow had left at the corner of her mouth, her eyes venomous and fixed on Kate.
"You'll pay for that, Katie," she said softly. "You and all your little pals had better watch out from now on, because I'm taking over for my worthless dead sister, and you are all going to pay."
Behind her glasses, Kate's soft brown eyes hardened. She glared down, meeting Clarissa's poisonous stare, then turned on her heel and went off down the corridor after her friends, not saying a word. Skaya gave the blonde a rather pitying look and followed. Utrina lingered a moment longer, alternating between wanting to get in some last comment and wanting to get the hell away from Clarissa, then went after Kate as well.
"Oh! And tell your trading house they'll be hearing from Daddy's lawyers, lizard boy!"
Clarissa shouted after Sky. They sat in the castle's library/game room, not saying much, for almost half an hour. Kate, Utrina, Juri Arisugawa, Skaya, Wakaba Shinohara, Miki Kaworu, and Dorothy Wainwright, scattered in the various armchairs and couches, some listlessly trying to read and not succeeding very well. Up on the mantelpiece above the fireplace, Lesser Mazinger and Tiny Robo tried to concentrate on their card game, but kept glancing worriedly at their owners and losing their places. Presently the door opened and Sionji entered, his long, lean face drawn and looking even leaner.
"Mr. Kaworu," he said hoarsely, "your assistance is required."
Miki looked up from the book he hadn't been reading, then nodded and got to his feet. Pausing, he glanced at Dorothy. The dark-eyed girl nodded with a faint expression that somehow combined a thoughtful smile with a worried frown, and Miki nodded back and trotted out.
"Damn it," said Kate bitterly. She was feeling so much better, too. Why the hell did Clarissa have to show up and...
She gestured meaninglessly in frustration, then sighed under her breath.
Fuck it.
Nobody disagreed. Upstairs, in room 304, Mia Ausa was unaware that any of this had happened. She was sorting out her room, unpacking the last of her things, which she'd recovered from storage the day before. Belana Torres, the Duelist Society's half-Klingon semi-mascot, was sitting on her desk. The reason she was sitting on the desk was because the chair was too low to the floor for her taste, and she couldn't sit on Mia's bed. Having been raised Minbari, Mia preferred sleeping on an incline, which made her bed more or less impossible to perch on and have a conversation.
"What's that?" Belana asked as Mia removed an item from one of the last plastic packing cases.
It looked like a stuffed animal of some kind, but what sort of animal, Belana couldn't be sure. Some kind of fish, maybe? It was roughly the size and shape of a basketball, but it had stubby little fins and an unusual number of little googly eyes on stalks. At another single eye, huge and staring, dominating most of its front side. Most of it was made of a sort of vivid green corduroy, with lurid round pink spots on its body, and fins of bright purple satin. Mia turned around, grinning, and hugged the disturbing item to her chest.
"It's Gorgon Ghidra," she said. "Isn't he just the cutest thing you've ever seen?"
Belana was no stranger to bizarre animal pets. Back on Kronos, she'd had a neighbor who had a pet Targ, which by human standards was about the most loathsome quadruped around. Still, it wasn't as if Krovor had ever claimed his targ was cute, or even particularly pleasant to have around. He'd liked it because it was disgusting and violent, much like its master.
"Oh, just look at him," Mia cajoled her, holding out the toy. "His round, pudgy body, his beady little eyes."
She squeezed the stuffed monster in her arms again, which caused it to emit a rather disturbing squeak.
"Oh, he just makes me melt," Mia went on, cuddling the Gorgon.
"Okay," said Bellana. "Well, fine," said Mia with mock annoyance. She gave the Gorgon a last squeeze, then put it on a shelf near her bed.
"You don't have to hug him, then."
Humming a happy little tune, she went back to unpacking her books. As she did so, she came to one, a large, leather-bound, metal-strapped volume, of a type of which she had several, and paused, looking at it with an interested expression.
"What?" said Bellana.
Mia carried the book across the room and laid it down on the end of the desk Bellana wasn't sitting on, then started leafing through its heavy yellowed pages, her tongue wedged in the corner of her mouth.